Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now! The U.S. is poised to strike Iraq again. We go back to the early days of the Gulf War with an American journalist taken hostage by Saddam Hussein. Elections in Bosnia this weekend, some say holding them now will dash all hopes for a permanent peace in the region. And the Dirty Dozen, Mother Jones profiles 12 Congress members giving corporate America its money's worth. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Two of the Clinton administration's senior officials on welfare policy resigned yesterday in protest of the law President Clinton signed last month, ending the federal guarantee of cash assistance to the nation's poorest children. The departure of the two officials, Mary Jo Bain and Peter Adelman, both assistant secretaries at the Department of Health and Human Services, illustrated the continuing deep divisions in the administration over President Clinton's decision to approve the Republican welfare legislation. Adelman is a longtime friend of the Clintons and husband of Marion Wright Adelman, head of the Children's Defense Fund. She has been blasting Clinton's decision to sign the bill for a month now. Adelman said, "I have devoted the last 30-plus years to doing whatever I could to help in reducing poverty in America. I believe the recently enacted welfare bill goes in the opposite direction." Mary Jo Bain, in an email message to colleagues, noted that her deep concerns about the welfare bill, quote, "have led me to conclude that I cannot continue to serve in the job." And these are the latest events on the presidential campaign trail. President Clinton has warned states to test inmates and parolees for drugs or lose federal cash. He said it's time to say to parolees, if you go back on drugs, you go back to jail. He said this at a rally in Pueblo, Colorado. Bob Dole is trying to calm GOP jitters, portraying himself as a lifetime survivor against long odds by reading a letter to gathered Republican Congress members in Washington. The 1945 letter informed Dole's father that his son's recovery from World War II wounds is somewhat questionable. Dole likened the missive to those who say he can't come from behind in the polls. And Jack Kemp is criticizing Clinton over his Iraq policy after Saddam Hussein fired missiles at U.S. jets patrolling the no-fly zone over northern Iraq. Kemp said in Augusta, Georgia, "It's very clear from the news from the Persian Gulf that there is a lot of vacillation and a failure by the president to clearly define the objective." Ross Perot has missed Texas's September 3rd deadline to replace stand-in Vice President James Campbell with running mate Pat Choate on the ballot. For the same reason, Campbell's name and not Choate's will appear on California's ballot. And Pat Choate said he and Perot expect to be included in both the presidential and vice presidential debates, a move he says should boost support for the Reform Party ticket. Whether both will be included will be decided by September 17th by a bipartisan debate commission. And you're listening to Democracy Now! The United States is sending more B-52 bombers and F-117 stealth fighter bombers to the region around Iraq. The move follows yesterday's attempt by Iraq to down two American F-16s patrolling the no-fly zone. Defense Secretary William Perry warned that if Iraq continues to aim missiles at U.S. jets, the American response will be disproportionate to the provocation. Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz called Kuwait's decision to host some of the U.S. warplanes a flagrant act of war against the Iraqi state. Meanwhile, thousands of Kurdish refugees have been flooding the borders with Iran and Turkey. Frank Smyth is a freelance journalist who was taken hostage by the Iraqi military for 18 days after the U.S. bombed Iraq. At the time, Smyth was working for the Village Voice and WCBS Radio. We were able to track him down this week in Asmara, Eritrea, in East Africa. I began by asking him what happened to the Kurds in the wake of the Gulf War.
Well, after the Gulf War, Kurdish rebels in the north of Iraq launched what they then called the Intifada, or the throwing off of Saddam Hussein's rule. That began on March 14th. And I went into northern Iraq with a number of other reporters about 7 or 8 days later. At that point, Kurdish guerrillas in the region, both the KDP and the PUK, were united, and they had liberated about 90% of northern Iraq, Kurdistan, Iraq, with the exception of the city of Mosul. I traveled with a number of other reporters from northwest of the country by Zako down to Kirkuk, And throughout that period, the Kurdish rebels were holding control. Along the way, we interviewed Barzani, the leader of the KDP in Erbil. It was unclear whether the Kurdish rebels were going to merely try to hold northern Iraq or whether or not they would attempt to join forces with Shiite rebels that were also fighting in southern Iraq and attempt to overthrow Saddam Hussein. However, at the end of March, after about 2 weeks of this liberated or intifada phase, Saddam Hussein began a counteroffensive using helicopter gunships, artillery, and tanks. And he was able to crush the rebellion and recapture most of Kurdistan, Iraq, within about 4 days.
What happened to you?
Myself and another, and a photographer were captured by Iraqi authorities. Another photographer, Gad Gross, was executed about an hour before our capture by Iraqi soldiers. They were going to execute us upon capture, but there was a Ba'ath Party official present when we were captured, who was not present, I don't believe he was present when the execution of Gad Gross took place. And this Ba'ath Party official argued with Special Forces commanders that since we were reporters or unknowns, that we would need to be interrogated by military intelligence and they should not execute us. So while one photographer was executed, the two of us who were captured later were then taken to various military intelligence centers and went through a period of a series of interrogations and then prison, and then after 18 days we were let go.
And who exactly was holding you?
Saddam Hussein's forces. We were being held by military intelligence at first, and then we were transferred to the main prison about 30 miles west of Baghdad.
And why did they decide to release you?
I think there was a running debate going on within the Iraqi government, with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the minister taking the position that we probably were reporters, while military intelligence was taking the view that we were probably a CIA and French intelligence agent, respectively. The photographer I was with is named Alain Bou, who was a French national. But I think at a certain point, Saddam was convinced. He ultimately made the decision that we were, in fact, reporters. And at that point, Saddam Hussein was trying to present a more liberal and more accommodating face to the outside world. And I think that he concluded we were more useful to him alive and being able to release us for the publicity gain rather than having us remain disappeared and killing us.
What did you find when you went through Kurdistan at that time? For example, Barzani, right now he is allied with Saddam Hussein. What were his feelings at the time?
At the time, he clearly identified Saddam Hussein as his enemy. He spoke of Saddam Hussein as someone who had oppressed the Iraqi people for a very long time. And Barzani was at that point allied with Talabani, the other main Kurdish leader, as well as with other groups, including the Kurdish Communist Party, to maintain a liberated Kurdistan, northern Iraq. And then the question, like I said before, was whether or not they were going to join forces and try to overthrow Saddam. But at that point, they saw themselves as a liberation movement that had finally thrown off Saddam Hussein's rule after decades, and they were determined to maintain that.
So were you surprised to hear that Barzani has allied with Saddam?
I was not. I'm not entirely surprised, because there's been a lot of rivalry that both predated the Gulf War and this uprising in 1991, and since then between Talabani's group and Barzani's group. However, I think it's incredibly disappointing that Barzani has made an alliance with Saddam Hussein. Apparently, he did this because Talabani's rival group was being backed by Iran, which has been true for some time. But for Barzani to make an alliance with Saddam Hussein now, I think, is terribly short-sighted, because this gives Saddam Hussein the opportunity to wipe out first Talabani's group and then, in the end, being able to control and contain Barzani's group. So certainly, this is at least as far as I can tell, it seems like a betrayal of everything that Barzani once claimed to stand for.
What was the attitude of the Kurds towards the United States 5.5 years ago after the U.S. bombing of Iraq?
The Kurdish attitude toward the U.S. bombing of Iraq, they weren't particularly concerned about that, because the bombing didn't really affect them terribly so in northern Iraq. Their concern is they didn't trust the United States, and they had reason to. The United States had backed the Kurds at various points in their history and then abandoned them and let them get crushed. And during the uprising in the post-Gulf War period, the Iraqi Kurds were looking to President Bush and looking to U.S. and other allied forces to support them in their uprising, but they were very suspicious of what their motives were and as to how far the U.S. coalition would go. They feared that they would be abandoned again. Though there were mixed feelings. Some people were so thrilled at President Bush's call, for example, for Saddam Hussein to be overthrown, that many newborn Kurdish babies were actually given the first name Bush. And then many of these same babies were killed or died of exposure, fleeing into Turkey and Iran. But clearly the attitude among the Kurds and among a lot of Kurdish leaders was they were hopeful that perhaps there could be a change, but they were very suspicious of the West. And in the end, the West really, I think, abandoned them and let them get crushed by Saddam's forces.
What did you make of what Bush did with the Kurds after the U.S. bombed Iraq? Why did he abandon them?
The problem was is that U.S. policy toward the Middle East since the fall of the Shah in Iran has been to contain Islamic fundamentalism. And Iraq and Saddam Hussein was only seen as a threat when Saddam Hussein became so militant and so expansionist that he eventually invaded Kuwait. But the driving force behind U.S. policy then, and I think to a certain degree now, remains containing Islamic fundamentalism. And what the Americans were afraid of, they wanted Saddam Hussein deposed in an internal coup led by so-called moderate factions within the Iraqi military, within the Sunni-dominated military. Yes. But what the United States was never willing to accept or encourage and always feared was the possibility of a popular insurrection in Iraq. 85% of Iraq's population are either Shiite Muslims, the same group that is dominant in Iran, or the Kurds in the north were Sunni Muslims but are quite distinct because of their Kurdish heritage. And if events had been allowed to unfold after the Gulf War, it seems clear that these Shiite and Kurdish forces might have overthrown Saddam. The problem then would be the Kurdish aspirations would be triggered elsewhere in the region, namely in Turkey, which is a clear strategic U.S. ally. And the United States was fearing the possible breakup of Iraq and further instability in the region spreading as a result of such an uprising. When I was in northern Iraq, the United States had made an agreement as part of the ceasefire with Saddam that he could only use helicopters for transport missions, that he could not use helicopters in any combat missions. But what the United States did was sat by and watched as helicopter gunships devastated the Kurds in the uprising, because Saddam Hussein had tanks and helicopters where the Kurds really only had small weapons, small automatic weapons, light rocket-propelled grenades and other small arms.
What about the CIA's involvement with Kurds in northern Iraq?
The CIA was very instrumental after the Gulf War in trying to back a group of Iraqi dissidents who had been in exile in London for the past 30 years, in trying to manipulate, maneuver to make sure that a pro-Western group would emerge dominant if and when Saddam Hussein was overthrown. But the CIA and the United States have never been particularly allied with the Kurds and have always been distrustful of them.
So here you have the U.S. slamming 44 cruise missiles into Iraq, saying they're protecting the Kurds, although they're doing it in southern Iraq and the Kurds are in northern Iraq. You have tens of thousands of Kurds attempting to flee into Iran, and Iran has closed the border. Do you think the Kurds are worse off than they were before the U.S. attack?
Oh, the Kurds are certainly worse off than they are. I think most of the blame lies with Mr. Barzani for making this alliance with Saddam Hussein. I think what's happening now is the United States is paying the price for the mess it left after the Gulf War. Regardless of what one thinks of the Gulf War, afterward the United States encouraged a popular insurrection and then stood by while the people that took that call, the Shiites in the south and the Kurds in the north, were wiped out. Since then, there's been an untenable situation has been maintained through U.S. support with this Kurdish enclave in the north. But I think now we're going back to business as normal. Saddam Hussein is reestablishing his control in the region. The Kurds, Barzani, has made, I think, a foolish, short-sighted alliance. And I think what's going to happen in the long run is that Saddam Hussein will return dominant in the region and will regain his authority over northern Iraq. And Kurdish aspirations for their own liberation will again be suppressed.
Why have the Kurds been fighting each other for so long?
I'm not sure. I think that goes back to rivalries within these groups that that go back decades. Barzani's father was known as the Immortal One for his leadership of the Kurdish struggle earlier in the century. But there's always been rivalries between Barzani and Talabani's group. But at various times they've been able to ally. I think now the problem is that people have been able to manipulate that. Saddam's been able to manipulate that. The United States has attempted to manipulate that. And certainly their infighting is really what the antecedent, which has led to their own downfall, at least in this case.
Have you followed the Turkish Kurds at all? And do you think the U.S. will be bombing Turkey anytime soon, considering their treatment of the Kurds?
No, I don't know much about the Turkish Kurds. What I do know is that the United States is very much allied with Turkey and has generally ignored Turkey's policies of crushing the Kurds and committing human rights violations in its own military campaign to crush its Kurdish rebels.
We're just wrapping up the interview, but I did want to ask you if you think, I mean, at one time the U.S. was closely allied with Saddam Hussein, providing him with weapons and support. They decided to turn around during the Persian, just before the Persian Gulf War. Can you see a U.S.-Saddam Hussein alliance anytime soon? And what about the U.S. relationship? What about what this means for the U.S. relationship with Iran?
I don't think a U.S. Saddam Hussein alliance is possible or feasible, both because it wouldn't be palatable politically in the United States, and also because I think the United States still perceives Saddam as an aggressor, and his actions would indicate that that it would be impossible to have any kind of reconciliation, even though the two countries worked very closely and were allied back in the late 1980s. In terms of U.S. policy in general, I think this is a defeat for the Kurds. It's also a loss for the United States, and I think you're going to go back to a situation where Saddam Hussein is able to dominate and crush aspiration attempts by the Kurds and the Shiites in his own country, and at the same time, the United U.S. influence in the region is going to decline, and I'm somewhat pessimistic about the future, but I don't see this as this is clearly a gain for Saddam, a loss for the Kurds, and a loss for the United States as well.
As we wrap up, Frank, I think it's important to note that as President Clinton engages in these increasingly unpopular actions like bombing Iraq, particularly unpopular in the Arab world, although he says he's protecting the nations surrounding Iraq and the Kurds, those nations, except for Kuwait, are not supporting what President Clinton is doing, and many populations see this as an attack on the Arab world. And so as he does this, at home, he's talking about enhancing counterterrorism measures like developing terrorist profiles at airports.
No, I think that's a serious problem, and I think that doesn't bode well for the future of civil liberties in the United States. I do think, however, that Clinton didn't lead this policy, which has now become a quagmire. I think he's following Bush's lead, and now I think Clinton is certainly in a position where he's not sure what to do with the mess that he now finds himself in.
Frank Smyth is a freelance journalist who was taken hostage by the Iraqi military for 18 days in 1991, just after the U.S. bombed Iraq. At the time, Smyth was working for the Village Voice and WCBS Radio. We tracked him down this week in Asmara, Eritrea, in East Africa. And this news from the New York Times yesterday in a piece by Tim Weiner. For the third time in a generation, a CIA program aimed against Iraq has sent the enemies of Saddam Hussein to prison or the grave. Several dozen Iraqis working with the Central Intelligence Agency inside Iraq were arrested and executed in July and August after President Saddam Hussein foiled the agency's latest effort to subvert him, this according to government officials. Their fate shows how hard it is to recruit spies in a police state and mount paramilitary operations in a land that is hostile like Iraq. The CIA has tried for more than 5 years to create political and paramilitary organizations that could supplant Saddam Hussein. And we got this news that yesterday, activist Dick Gregory and talk show host Joe Madison got arrested outside the CIA in Langley, Virginia, for protesting the revelations by the San Jose Mercury News, which Democracy Now! Covered last week, saying that the CIA funneled tons of drugs into the African-American community in Los Angeles through the Crips and the Bloods, sending the profits from those sales to the Nicaraguan Contras. Also this afternoon, Los Angeles Congressmember Maxine Waters and the Congressional Black Caucus will hold a public hearing in Washington, D.C. to strategize about what to do in response to the recent revelations of the CIA drug operation. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we're going to take a look at the elections coming up in Bosnia this weekend, and then we'll look at the Dirty Dozen, those 12 Congress members who are giving corporate America its money's worth. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. This weekend, President Clinton's Bosnia policy will be put to a crucial test. Bosnian Muslims, Croats, and Serbs will go to the polls in the first national election since the end of the bloody civil war in that country. But the election alone cannot heal this fractured nation. The campaigns themselves have been nationalistic and divisive. The Bosnian election itself is a massive undertaking. Tens of thousands of refugees are expected to cross former battle lines to vote in the hometowns they fled during the war. And there are serious concerns that Bosnia could explode again into violence even before election results are in. We're joined by two people who know the situation well there. Kamal Krspasic joins us from our Washington station, WPFW. He's the Washington correspondent for the Sarajevo Daily. And joining us here in New York is Bogdan Denic, director of the Institute for Transition to Democracy in Zagreb and Belgrade, and a professor of sociology and chair of the faculty at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Let's begin with you, Professor Denic. You've just returned from the area. Can you describe what's happening in preparation for the elections?
Well, the three nationalist parties are preparing for the election by preventing any of their rivals from having any chance at all. The control of the media is almost total. Opposition leaders have been beaten up. Meetings have been broken up. The refugees are not allowed in. The Serb area has kept the Muslims out. The Muslim leadership has not permitted its opposition any chance, and the Croats don't even pretend that there's going to be an election. So I am extremely pessimistic about this charades, which I think is mainly directed at the elections in the United States, and to permit the Clinton administration to say that they've solved something. I think they've solved nothing, and I think that it's a part of the general disastrous move towards a permanent partition of Bosnia. We will end up this election with predictable results. The three nationalist parties will remain in power, and they will be given extra legitimacy. They're not all equally bad, by the way, but they're all bad.
Well, let's get the response of Kamal Krspasic, who is in Washington right now. What do you feel about the elections this weekend?
I agree with Professor Denic in his assessment that these elections are not going to be free or fair. That's obvious that many things in the Dayton Agreement, civilian side of the agreement, were not implemented, beginning with freedom of movement and right of return of those who were expelled from their homes and towns. And under such conditions, we really can't expect any decent elections there. What I see as possibility is for international sponsors of the Dayton Agreement to recommit themselves to that agreement and to help sustain and sustain Bosnia and to help create atmosphere for elections in 2 years, which are also part of the agreement. Since 3.5 years of war, practically destroyed all legitimacy of elected governments in 90. Those were those three nationalistic parties that won elections, led to the war, and the same parties will win these elections. So I don't see any change in Serb party agenda to create greater Serbia, in Croat nationalistic party agenda to create greater Croatia, and I see even Muslim party of SDA, which was not responsible for the war in the first place, I see them resigning to the reality of existence of three separate entities and to existence of small Muslim state, and that gives some encouragement and rise to Muslim extremism as well. And the way out of this is not in these elections. I don't see any positive outcome of that. The chance, the only opportunity that internationally we have for Bosnia is to have decent elections in 98.
But you are actually for the elections this weekend. You're not opposed to them.
I just don't see, you know, that's agreement. They signed it. They decided. I would blame a Bosnian government, not American government, for accepting, for forcing elections on September 14. I think that accepting elections under such conditions amounted to practically accepting the movement towards partition. In that sense, I think that whatever elected government in cantonal, in entity level, in federal level we have, will have some more legitimacy than nowadays self-styled leaderships. And unfortunately, we can't expect other people, other parties, and that's where Professor Denich is right. But still, we don't have a choice.
Professor Denich, do you think there is a choice?
I think there was a choice. I think there was a choice by the decent forces in the West to denounce the charades, which was imposed primarily by the United States. The European countries were not particularly enthusiastic. The Bosnian government was not particularly enthusiastic. And I think we will be worse off because the elections are going to be used in the Muslim part, which was the best of the three, to eliminate the secular parties, which are now which is the mayor of Tuzla, the second biggest city in Bosnia, and the other social democratic and secular parties, which are simply not being given a chance. They will now be swamped in an artificial election where the military and the police are making it impossible for them to campaign. They've even confiscated election material on the grounds that it criticizes the ruling party, which is an absurdity. The Croat part, by the way, is by far the worst. And there the West has caved in again and again and again to the Croat refusal to accept the federation with the Bosnians and to accept the results of the elections in Mostar, which were a portent of what happens. A, the elections will be phony. B, none of the warlords are going to accept any results they don't please. And C, it's an alibi for the U.S., to cut and run, or at least radically reduce its presence there. I think my colleague would be right if it wasn't for the record we have for over 4 years of constant waffling on the part of the West. There did not need to be a 250,000 dead and 3 million refugees in the heart of Europe. That was a man-made disaster. And it was a man-made disaster that was participated in by very good, decent people in the West who saw murder done and did nothing about it. Now they're going to, in my opinion, wash their hands of the thing and accept the de facto partition. I see no evidence that they're going to press for a united secular Bosnia, and unfortunately, the three major players that they're turning power over with are adamantly opposed to such a thing.
We're talking to Professor Bogdan Denich, director of the Institute for Transition to Democracy in Zagreb, Croatia, and Belgrade, Serbia. And we also have with us in our Washington studio Kamal Krspahic, and he is Washington correspondent for the Sarajevo Daily. You know, we often say on Democracy Now! That in terms of foreign policy, there is very little that distinguishes Bob Dole from President Clinton. Kamal Krspahic, can you lay out what their positions on Bosnia have been, and if they do differ, have they over the years?
There was a substantial difference in Bob Dole advocating in the last 3 years some more more radical response to the aggression against Bosnia, which was a lifting of arms embargo, which kept Bosnia's hand tied through the course of the war, and airstrikes against Serbian strategic positions. It's interestingly enough, that was also President Clinton's position when he assumed the power, when he came to the White House in May 93. He personally proposed lift and strike. And then when he had Congress, both houses in Congress, Senate and the House, in favor of lifting of embargo, he gave in to European resistance to that. And unfortunately, the action was postponed for 3 years, which gave enough time to the forces of destruction to practically destroy, dismember the country. That was the main difference between two of them. The other main difference was, of course, that Clinton was the president and Dole was just Senate majority leader, which, you know, gives him more room to be more radical. I don't know whether if Dole was the president, he would do the things that he said he wanted to do. I mean, being disappointed with how all leaders in office dealt with Bosnia and having support of all former, all prospective leaders, I'm just not sure whether they change once they enter the office.
Professor Denich, what are your thoughts on why...
Well, my colleague, as usual, is a very optimist and believes in the goodness, the natural goodness of mankind. I don't. I think that basically Dole played demagogia games, which are easy for the person out of office, just as Clinton did, as he pointed out. And I think that it was not the European parties alone that stopped the lift and strike policy. I think it was, above all, the strategic ally that the U.S. has picked in the area, which is the Croat government of Franjo Tudjman, which was adamantly opposed to arming the Bosnians, having just fought a murderous little war against the Bosnians, and wanting to maintain an upper hand. We have an unrearing instinct in the U.S. to pick our local sons of bitches very badly. And in this case, we've picked a government which, while originally a victim of Serbian aggression, is in terms of democracy and its Bosnian policy indistinguishable from the Serb government, probably actually a little worse in the case of ethnic cleansing. Since we have our hand in a cookie jar there, having armed them and trained them, we couldn't very well go around and really arm the Bosnian government properly. And I suspect that policy will need to be reversed. It's increasingly clear that the government we've picked to back is a nationalist government that is engaged in ethnic cleansing. And I think that short of a willingness of the United States and Europe to impose a settlement on behalf of the peoples there, nothing will happen. We tend to accept these leaders as legitimate. None of them won a fair election. Ali Izetbegovic was not elected president of Bosnia. There was a five-man presidency elected. The Croat and the Serb leaders were not elected on a platform of dismembering Bosnia. On the contrary, they promised that they would rule together. The notion that just because somebody's ahead of a government, they represent the hapless people there, is something we really have to get rid of. I think the vast majority of Bosnian people want an end to this damn war, and to being reduced to a set of squabbling Bantustans which have no economic way of surviving.
Let's talk for a minute about the candidates that are running right now. Kemal Krspahic, can you just give us a profile of who these people are?
As I said in the beginning, those are same people, same parties that won elections in 90 and led to the war. Those are the likely winners of this elections, and that's the main problem, that that the conditions for free elections were not created. The opposition parties really don't have fair shot at these elections. They did not have a fair opportunity to campaign publicly or on the air. Independent TV station or network of TV stations to support that campaign was created just a week before the elections. And of course, that was not enough to change anything in the environment. And I don't see real challenge to nationalistic parties at at elections as rushed as they are for September 14th. And I can't expect a major success of any of opposition parties, even though there are really decent candidates in the field and decent joint groups of the parties, like there is a joint list of five opposition parties which runs in Bosnian Croat Federation. Unfortunately, whole electoral rules are designed in the way that they support partition. Some voters can vote only within Republika Srpska, some voters can vote only within Federation, and they are divided as electorate. So electoral rules are practically, you know, while there are a lot of crocodile tears for multi-ethnic Bosnia in the West and support for and concern for multi-ethnic parties, actually whole electoral rules were designed in order to support exactly as forces of partition. And finally, whatever happens in these elections, and that's the only point I you know, made in the beginning, is whatever happens now, that won't be fair, and that won't be a real picture of what Bosnians want and what they need desperately. So what we need is support for a creation of environment for real elections in 2 years, which means recommitment to Dayton principles by those who sponsored it, beginning with the United States and the European Union. And there are a few things that were not done and have to be done in order to help Bosnia restart their lives. One is freedom of movement. The other is right of return of those expelled from their homes. And, of course, an environment in which opposition can be free to express itself and create platforms and practically present itself to the public. So for me, elections 96 are just and even if you want a wrong step, but a step in the peace process. And what we need are 2 years of peace and support to have another chance in 2 years.
Professor Denich, who is going to be able to vote on Saturday? Can people vote in absentia? What's the system that's been set
Some
up?
Some people vote several times. It's a nice old Chicago habit. But essentially, in theory, all refugees who've registered abroad will have an option of voting either where they lived in 1991, which may be, of course, a non-existent place, or, and this is the dangerous part, where they would want to live, which is, of course, a way of turning these elections into seal of approval on ethnic cleansing. So Serb refugees will be directed to vote in those Muslim towns that they want to keep. Croat refugees will vote in towns where they've kicked the Muslims out of, and Muslims will vote in those towns they want to hang on to. There is absolutely no way of really controlling that. So this enormous apparatus we've set up for controlling how fair the elections are is a cynical fraud. That is, what they will control is that the votes are counted right. But whether the people who voted had the right to vote there or there's no way of controlling. It will be particularly difficult to control the votes of people in Germany and in Austria and in the camps, because there, I think there'll be many intermediaries. I think that we have to realize that this election is a disaster, and it's a disaster made in Washington, not in Sarajevo. It's the U.S. government policy that is responsible for this debacle, and is responsible for a de facto partition, and for the fact that war criminals are not only walking the streets of Bosnia, but unindicted ones, and there are more unindicted ones than indicted ones, will be in government.
What do you think, then, people here in this country can do?
We have to start raising our voices to the senators, to the congressmen, to the White House, saying that this is an intolerable crime for that the U.S. is involved in, and that they have to stop playing games with the war crimes business. They are actually shaking hands with war criminals, Croat war criminals in this case. I happen to think that there, you know, if we had a fair trial, most of the war criminals would be Serb, yes. But there are lots of Croat war criminals, and they're very high up in the Croat government. And there are lots of Serb war criminals, and they're very high up. I think that the two presidents, by the way, Milosevic and Tudjman, in a fair world, would be facing the trials at Hague. Of course, they'd receive different sentences. But the fact is, small fry are going to be tried, and we are playing games, saying we want to get Karadzic and Mladic, who are absolutely the worst guys, and in effect arming some of the people who are war criminals.
On that note, we have to wrap up, and I want to thank you very much for joining us, Professor Bogdan Denic, Director of the Institute for Transition to Democracy in Zagreb, Croatia, and Belgrade, Serbia. And we also want to thank Kamal Krspahic. He is the Washington correspondent for the Sarajevo Daily. You're listening to Democracy Now! We will certainly bring you the results of the elections next week in Bosnia. And next up, we're going to talk about the Dirty Dozen, Congress members who are accepting money from corporate America, and well, let's just say their votes are following suit. This shouldn't come as any surprise. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. With campaign spending in this election cycle breaking all previous records, there's some sporadic attention in the corporate media to the influence of campaign donations on legislative and executive decisions. But this month's issue of Mother Jones magazine goes further than most of the press has been willing to go by tracing exactly what Republicans and Democrats are willing to do for their sponsors. Mother Jones has selected what it's called a dirty dozen, 9 Republicans and 3 Democrats, who've been the most blatant in rewarding legislative favors to campaign contributors. Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky wrote one of the 12 profiles. He's now back with us after a vacation, and yesterday he spoke with Mother Jones publisher Jay Harris about the dirty dozen members of Congress.
Jay Harris, you chose a dozen members of Congress. There are 435. There are certainly more than a dozen who have the kind of sins, basically sins of taking a hell of a lot of money and doing favors in return, that you could have chosen. How'd you come up with these 12?
Well, we picked these 12 because we felt that they were particularly emblematic of the corruption in the 104th Congress. We have leaders, particularly Republican leadership, who have set new standards in sellout of legislation to big contributors. We've had freshman Republicans who have come in on a bandwagon of reform only to sell out to a greater extent than any of their predecessors. And we have Democrats who have turned a blind eye to the sins of their Republican colleagues because they're in the same game of taking money. And we thought we picked a selection of 12 that we think sort of best exemplify this, although I'm sure you could come up with lots of candidates of your own.
Well, indeed, I did come up with one candidate of my own. I have to have a self-confession here of personal interest. One of the 12 profiles in this new issue of Mother Jones is one written by me, of Steve Stockman of Texas, who is someone who is funded very lavishly by the gun lobby, and he's not the only one, the National Rifle Association. Talk for a second, if you would, about the National Rifle Association and its way of working its magic in Congress.
Well, the NRA is one of the largest funders of candidates in Congress, not just Republicans. They have a lot of Democratic supporters, and they give away a lot of money through their PACs. The way they have managed to hold on to the votes, in sort of in contradiction to what public opinion seems to run about guns, is really staggering, and they do it by money. They enforce it by giving lavish sums to people that support them, and when somebody turns against them, just giving lavish sums to their opponents.
Now, this is basically the way that government is running these days, as these 12 profiles make clear. If you have the organized money, if you are a trade association, if you are a lobbying group, if you have a political action committee or PAC, you can have a hell of a lot of clout. Why do you think that this has been allowed to go on for so long in this manner, and indeed now metastasized to a tremendous cancer on the American body politic?
Well, the big turn in campaign finance has been the loophole of soft money. In the 80s, the early 80s, soft money, which is the money that's given by these special interest groups to the parties, not to individual candidates, has just mushroomed. And it has, and because of that, and because the parties have become so addicted to the dollars, we've had a system where there's really a race to the highest bidder in both parties. So I think what we have is, you know, we've always had politicians who are willing to do favors for their big contributors. But to just use one statistic, the Democrats raised in the same period in the 92 election cycle something like $20 million in soft money. They're up to $68 million in soft money in this presidential election cycle. The amount of money going into the system from these corporate interests is staggering.
But you could say it's predictive but not determinative. In other words, there are cases where an underfunded or vastly underfunded candidate wins over a hugely funded candidate. Do you see that happening in any of the cases this time, of the Dirty Dozen you picked out or any others in Congress, where money is really not going to win the day?
Well, we did single out in our couple of angels in addition to the Dirty Dozen. Well, one of them is Lynn Rivers, who's a blue-collar, 39-year-old woman from Ann Arbor, Michigan, who campaigned really as an average woman to represent you in Congress. And she won against long odds from a district that, of course, has got some blue-collar sympathies. Money is not determinative, but in this system where so much depends upon television and being able to get into the airwaves and spin your message, it winds up being the way of choice for most.
Speaking of being able to get into the airwaves and spin your message, I remember several months ago when I was in Washington, Amy Goodman and I interviewed Jeffrey Klein, the editor-in-chief of Mother Jones, around the tobacco issue, mm-hmm. when you had this expose of Bob Dole and others being basically bought and sold by the tobacco interests. In Dole's case, he's also bought and sold by other interests. But at that time, we were wondering, Jeffrey was on a publicity tour back east, how the major media were going to pick this up. We knew he was going to be interviewed by Pacifica probably 6 or 8 times, counting the local stations. But was this going to be something that the major media picked up? How do you think that's working as far as the Dirty Dozen that you've gotten here? You've got these people nailed. A lot of the stuff, I must say, I've read before in dribs and drabs in establishment media, really the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Times, they all cover this. But what does it take to get a critical mass of media going that'll rival the kind of messages you're talking about that get bought by the candidates?
It's a great question. The example of the tobacco, frankly, it made it into the national headlines because Bob Dole himself stumbled. I think Mother Jones' big contribution to that story, in addition to doing the basic reporting, was to sensitize the reporting crowd to the prediction that Bob Dole was going to stumble if asked if nicotine was addictive. Sure enough, somebody asked him the question, and sure enough, he compared smoking tobacco to drinking milk. Now, because Mother Jones had done that work, that stumble became a story. People were sort of ready. They knew that there was collusion with Bob Dole and tobacco. How to do it with these others? I think you've got to have this combination of egregious corruption, as in Tom DeLay and his brother, Randy DeLay, who's taking, you know, making $500,000 in his first year as a lobbyist by lobbying his brother. And, you know, some kind of trip up, I think, that is in a much more mundane way going to bring him into the headlines of the mainstream. If I knew there were the secret, I would sure be broadcasting it.
Well, sometimes this leads to people actually going to prison, as in the case of Dan Rostenkowski, for example. Not the only member of Congress to have gone to prison in recent years, but certainly one of the most notorious before his fall from power. Is there any sign that the judicial branch of the government wants to engage with these people, for example, who are basically selling the government out for campaign contributions? And isn't it going to take that kind of exposure, which in this country becomes very effective when it gets into a sense of a courtroom drama, to make this change?
I wish I were hopeful that would come out of our judicial system. There's no sign that either major party wants to break the stranglehold of money on the system. They're both in cahoots with it. We are at this point resorting to the fact that Ross Perot picks as a running mate a fellow who's pretty articulate on the sellout of the system to special interests to get it even into the newspapers. Where will it go from there? Well, I don't know. The electorate is peeved about it, but they don't know exactly how they're being screwed. And I think it's, you know, here we are to at the margins trying to make the case of what's really going on. Occasionally, with a Bob Dole, it gets into the front pages. But you get people like Gephardt, who's in our Dirty Dozen, who has a $2 million advantage against his opponent and who pays lip service to campaign reform. He is not going to lead change in the system. It has to come from outside.
Let's get down to a few specifics here. One of the things I didn't know, Jay Harris, before I read the September-October issue of Mother Jones, is about Tom DeLay and his brother. And I don't know if I could say I was shocked, because probably I'm beyond shock, but I certainly was astonished to learn that here is a guy who has, as we've seen exposed before, invited lobbyists in to write anti-environmental legislation, which is to the benefit of the companies that they lobby for. But it turns out that his own brother represents those lobbies. Is this legal?
Unfortunately, it is. It is also now the subject of an ethics complaint in Congress. The activities of Randy DeLay and the collusion with his brother Tom DeLay have been noticed by the powers that be in Congress. Randy DeLay, who is an attorney in Houston, registered as a lobbyist 2 years ago. In his first full year as a political lobbyist, he made $500,000. 60% of which came from clients with interest before his brother.
One of the things I think the readers of Mother Jones may be a little surprised by is the fact that you didn't go exclusively at Republicans in choosing this Dirty Dozen. Three of the Dirty Dozen, in fact, are Democrats, including two who could be said to be damaged in their campaigns because their campaigns may be close, Vic Fazio and Jane Harman, both of them here in California. Was there any of the type of thinking that you hear around saying, well, wait a minute, maybe we may or not do this, it's going to be a close election, Fazio and Harman are perhaps part of a very narrow Democratic majority that may emerge from this, do we want to give their opponents ammunition, any of that kind of thinking in your editorial process here?
It's a good question. I mean, we are very aggressively nonpartisan in our selections. The fact is, Mother Jones has a long track record at looking at the corrupting influence of money in our political system. If I wish it were as simple as it only being a problem of one party, it's not. It's both. You have somebody like a Vic Fazio who has done a huge sellout to agricultural interests and was against. People in his own party fought to defend corporate subsidies for agricultural corporations. You have somebody like Jane Harman, who is getting praised by the Sierra Club for her environmental record at the same time that she's defending the latter-day Star Wars, the ballistic missile defense system that Clinton morphed Star Wars into.
Much of what is based in her district as far as the major military contractors go.
Yeah, it's certainly in the interests of her district, but she's, by the same token, we've got a Democratic president and his allies in Congress who, at the one hand, are saying, oh, Star Wars was a dumb idea, it's based on bad science, and on the other hand, perpetuating it under another name. And we think that's not only bad policy, it's blatant hypocrisy.
As you look at these campaigns going on across the country, not only of your so-called Dirty Dozen, but of other newly elected, especially Republican first-term members of the House of Representatives, do you think the fact that, as one of your pundits says somewhere in one of these articles, that the fact that they came to clean up Washington and stayed just to clean up, do you think that's going to operate against them?
I hope so. The public has a right to be cynical about the potential for reform out of this particular group. And Mother Jones wants to simultaneously keep hope alive on the prospects of reform while being very, very specific about how the sellout continues. I think when we, you know, when we go in to vote, when we go in to figure out who the next candidates may be, when we see how to mobilize against the long odds of special interest money, you know, we have to be very clear about what we're up against, and that's what we try to document here.
One of the more intriguing stories that you tell in the dozen, and again, one that I did not know about beforehand, was the relationship of Sue Myrick, who is a first-term Republican from North Carolina, former mayor of Charlotte, with the Amway Corporation. Now, the Amway Corporation, as you write about it here, has more than 500,000 United States independent distributors who only make an average of $88 a month, your writer Rachel Burstein points out. This, however, gets to be kind of a very powerful pyramid scheme when you think about 500,000 people out there who think that the election of people with a certain ideology may help them actually right away make money. It's in a way more powerful or as powerful as ideological motivation of the Christian Coalition when it doesn't, of course, overlap with the Christian Coalition.
Well, the Amway Corporation is one of the items that we point out in our story is that the Amway Corporation in their chain of distributors has a voicemail system called Amvox, which is used by the distributors to get messages to their, quote, downlines, the distributors beneath them in the chain. What that's being used for, and it has been used for in the case of Sue Myrick and also one of our favorites, Oliver North, has been to distribute campaign messages, including encouragements to support candidates financially through the Amvox system. Now, we question the Federal Election Commission about this, and there seems to be some question about whether this is even legal.
There's that word again, legal. You know, you think, well, if this is legal, it should be illegal. But the people who would make it illegal are the very same people who are benefiting from the system. And therefore, the question we ask over and over again on Pacifica and Democracy Now! And other programs is, how is this ever going to change short of, excuse the expression, a revolution?
Well, we have, you know, there are initiatives on the California ballot this year to try to drive the money out of politics in California. And certainly at the state level, you know, Missouri and Maine and Colorado and you know, dozens of states around the country have either passed reform, maybe at some points only to have it caught up in courts, or have the potential to pass reform soon. I think it's going to be grassroots. It's not going to come out of Washington. And people have to sort of focus on the local level in order to sort of initiate the change.
Jay Harris, publisher of Mother Jones, whose September-October edition is featuring big cover story with another great illustration, Newt Gingrich and the Dirty Dozen, 12 of the most rotten eggs now sitting in Congress, one of whom, Steve Stockman of Texas, is profiled by me, Larry Bensky.
And thank you for that report, Larry. Again, the Dirty Dozen, Congressmembers Tom DeLay, David McIntosh, Bob Barr, Sue Myrick, Richard Gephardt, Thomas Bliley, Helen Chenoweth, Jane Harmon, John Christensen, Steve Stockman, John Ensign, and Vic Fazio. You're listening to Democracy Now!, produced by Julie Drizin, our engineer, Errol Maitland, our director, Brother Shine. If you'd like a copy of today's show, the number to call is 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow, it's the 25th anniversary of the Attica Uprising. We'll be doing a special. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!